The fact that you saw fit to promote me certainly figured into his plan to even the score, as it were. The Emperor nodded.
Ironic, is it not, that his attempt to increase his own cachet should end up benefiting so many of his seeming competitors?
It was true. Naval intelligence had been folded back into military intelligence, and Colonel Wolf Yularen had been designated to take Rancid's place as deputy director. Harris Eisen had been moved into the ubiquitate. Admiral Tennant had been made a joint chief. Motti, Tag, and others had received similar upgrades. Yularen's promotion especially had come as a relief to Tarkin, who had feared that the Emperor might assign him to Rancid's former position.
We need to tighten our hold over the outer systems, the Emperor continued. You will be in charge of that, Moff Tarkin. Or should I say, Grand Moff Tarkin.
Tarkin gaped in genuine surprise.
Grand Moff?
The Empire's first.
The Emperor spread his sickly hands.
Was it not you who suggested the creation of oversectors and oversector governance as a means of enhancing our control?
It was, my lord.
Then your wish is granted. The Outer Rim is yours to oversee. And with it, Grand Moff Tarkin, the whole of the Mobile Battle Station project.
Tarkin rose from his chair so he could bow from the waist in frank obedience.
I will not fail you.
When he looked up, he saw that the Emperor was leaning forward in his chair.
It will be a momentous responsibility,
the Emperor said, drawing out the words.
For once the battle station is fully operational, you will wield the ultimate power in the galaxy.
Tarkin's gaze moved from the Emperor to Vader and back again. I don't believe that will ever be the case, my lord. Considering that the Emperor had created the title Grand Moff for Tarkin, he had not been promoted so much as escalated. No secret was made of it, in any case, except regarding his oversight of the battle station project. And for the 2 weeks that he remained on the galactic capital, following the meeting with the Emperor and Vader, he was honored and feted wherever he went. He granted lengthy interviews to top media outlets throughout the Corps, announcing his intention to embark on a tour of the major systems of the Outer Rim, beginning with his native Iriadu. None of the interviewers pressed him about where he had spent the past 3 years, and no one brought up Antar IV. It was as if the post-war events that had occurred on the Gotal moon had passed into ancient history, or mythology. The recent attacks on facilities in the outer and mid-rim, as well as the holovids that had been circulated, were made to seem part of an imperial plan to root out dissident cells. Tarkin was quoted as saying, "The factor that contributed most to the demise of the Republic was not in fact the war, but rampant self-interest. Endemic to the political process our ancestors engineered, the insidious pursuit of self-enrichment grew only more pervasive through the long centuries, and in the end left the body politic feckless and corrupt. Consider the self-interest of the core worlds, unwavering in their exploitation of the outer systems for resources. The outer systems themselves, undermined by their permissive disregard of smuggling and slavery. Those ambitious members of the Senate who sought only status and opportunity. The reason our Emperor was able to negotiate the dark waters that characterized the terminal years of the Republic and remain at the helm through a catastrophic war that spanned the galaxy is that he has never been interested in status or self-glorification. On the contrary, he has been tireless in his devotion to unify the galaxy and assure the well-being of its myriad populations. Now, with the institution of sector and oversector governance, we are in the unique position to repay our debt to the Emperor for his decades of selfless service,
by lifting some of the burden of quotidian rulership from his shoulders. By partitioning the galaxy into regions, we actually achieve a unity previously absent. Where once our loyalties and allegiances were divided, they now serve one being, with one goal, a cohesive galaxy in which everyone prospers. For the first time in 1,000 generations, our sector governors will not be working solely to enrich Coruscant and the core worlds, but to advance the quality of life in the star systems that make up each sector, keeping the spaceways safe, maintaining open and accessible communications, assuring that tax revenues are properly levied and allocated to improving the infrastructure. The Senate will likewise be made up of beings devoted not to their own enrichment, but to the enrichment of the worlds they represent. This bold vision of the future requires not only the service of those of immaculate reputation and consummate skill in the just exercise of power, but also the service of a vast military dedicated to upholding the laws necessary to ensure galactic harmony. It may appear to some that the enactment of universal laws and the widespread deployment of a heavily armed military are steps toward galactic domination, but these actions are taken merely to protect us from those who would invade, enslave, exploit, or foment political dissent, and to punish accordingly any who engage in such acts. Look on our new military not as trespassers or interlopers, but as gatekeepers, here to shore up the Emperor's vision of a pacified and prosperous galaxy. The media took to calling it the Tarkin Doctrine, and some commentators began to wonder if he wasn't destined to become the new voice of the Empire. He made it his business to meet with senators representing star systems over which he now had authority. Most seemed relieved about having to answer to him rather than the Emperor or the ruling council, but he made clear to one and all that he wouldn't tolerate acts of sedition or anti-imperial propaganda, and that he would be merciless with all perpetrators. He met, too, with the joint chiefs of the army and the navy, and with the directors and top officers in the intelligence agencies. Through them, he instituted changes at Desolation Station, replacing many key personnel and altering supply schedules and convoy routes. He authorized re-evaluations of every scientist and technician and established new parameters for both secrecy and security. He ordered that no convoys were to move without adequate protection, and to the dismay of countless beings in systems along the supply routes, he limited the holonet to imperial use. The populations of those worlds viewed his actions as the start of an imperial conquest of the Outer Rim. At Geonosis, he enacted procedures that would limit contact between workers, whether contractors, employees, or slaves, and the outside galaxy. Leaves were cancelled, and communications of any sort were strictly monitored. He reinforced Sentinel Base and the marshalling stations and deployed patrol flotillas to the nearby systems. His most trusted officers were sent in search of pirates and smugglers, with orders to eliminate them on sight. To complement his new station, he designed and had made a grey-green uniform whose thick-belted, round-collared tunic featured four code cylinders and a rank plaque of 12 multicoloured squares, 6 blue over trios of red and gold. In all dealings with the Emperor, he was referred to as Grand Moff, but for ordinary interactions with military personnel, he retained the honorific Governor. His agenda on Coruscant complete, he travelled from the core to the Greater Sesuena sector aboard the Executrix, which was now his personal vessel.
"The least the Empire can do to compensate you for the loss of the Carrion Spike,"
the Emperor had said on awarding him the Imperial-class Star Destroyer. In addition to the thousands of troops and technicians who staffed and crewed the massive ship, he had a personal bodyguard of 32 stormtroopers who accompanied him wherever he went, or at least when he allowed as much. Arriving by Imperial shuttle at Phelar Spaceport, he was greeted by cheering crowds, media representatives, and a military marching band. In Iriadu City, he visited with family and old friends and granted more interviews. The local governor, who happened to be a relative, awarded him the key to the city and held a parade in his honor. While residing at his former home, he sat for a sculptor who had been commissioned to create a statue that would stand in the city's principal public space. He had one last mission to carry out before he left his homeworld, and with some effort he managed to persuade his platoon of personal guards that it was an undertaking he needed to fulfill alone, as it was a kind of personal pilgrimage. The stormtroopers were not pleased, as it was their duty to protect him, but they relented inasmuch as he would be spending his time on ancestral ground. Potential assassins notwithstanding, he made no show of secrecy the morning he left for the plateau. In an old airspeeder that had gone unused for years by anyone residing at the family estate. Once removed from the confines of Iriadu City, he relaxed into the journey, almost as if in an attempt to re-experience the annual trips he had made to the plateau as a youth. He even wore clothes of the sort he would have worn in those days, more suited to a hunter or trekker than to an imperial Grand Moff. When, after several hours of ragged flight, the plateau and surrounding volcanic terrain came into view, he felt as if he had never left. And indeed he hadn't, because he had carried the place within him wherever he had ventured. He had been accused by lovers and others of being heartless, but it wasn't true. It was simply that his heart was here, in this pristine part of his homeworld. His attachment to the place was not as one who worshipped nature, rather as one who had learned to tame it. And he would leave the area unchanged, the animals and riotous growth, as a reminder of the control he exercised over it. He took the airspeeder through several passes over the plateau, observing herds of migrating animals. The day was bright and clear, and he could see in detail everywhere he looked. Ultimately, he landed the antique vehicle on the savannah, close to the hill of boulders he had come to climb. He set out on foot, with the legs of his trousers tucked into his high boots and the sleeves of his lightweight shirt secured at the wrist as protection against swarms of stinging insects. Arrived at the hill, he began to pick his way up over the pitted rocks, leaping over crevasses and finding finger and toe holds as he bouldered to the summit. The hill seemed a lonelier place without its troop of guardian Veermox, but also a more sacred one, sanctified by what he had accomplished here. He was breathing hard when he reached the top, the hot wind blowing across the rocks and garish light reflecting from the obsidian pool at the base of the spike. He had given thought to scaling the column, but realized now that it was enough simply to stand at its base and savor his recollections. He lingered for hours, as a Veermock might have, sprawled on the warmed rocks, allowing himself to become nearly dehydrated in the heat. He left as that part of the planet was slipping into darkness, carefully picking his way down the boulders, a task more difficult than the ascent. One skid, one wrong step or stumble. Returned to the tall grass, he followed traces of the path left by his earlier transit. Then, as if avoiding obstacles concealed by the stalks, began to pursue a more zigzag route as he neared the airspeeder and an isolated patch of forest beyond. The noise of his legs swooshing through the grass competed with the buzz and drone of insect life. Otherwise, there was only the sound of his respiration and the faint echo of his movements. He was 50 or so meters from the airspeeder when he heard the sound of branches snapping and giving way behind him, and the surprised exclamation of the human who had fallen into the trap. Pleased with himself, he stopped, turned about, and started for the pit he had excavated so many years earlier. "Welcome, Wilhuff," someone said from the towering grass off to his left before he reached the pit. Jova stood from where he had been hiding. He was gnarled, wrinkled, and deeply tanned, but still sprightly for his age. 30 additional years of living on the carrion didn't seem to have done him too much harm. Parting the savanna grass with leathery hands, he began to make his way toward Tarkin, proffering a sleek blaster when they reached each other.
"He dropped this when he fell in," the old man said. "A Westar, isn't it?"
Tarkin nodded as he accepted the blaster, switched off the safety, and tucked it into the waistband of his trousers.
"Where's his speeder, Uncle?"
Jova's crooked finger pointed east.
"Behind the trees. I thought he might follow you up the hill, but he stayed at the bottom, making a little nest for himself in the grass, then tracked you when you came down and started for your ship."
Together they walked to the pit to gaze down at Teller, some 4 meters below them. Somewhat stunned by the unexpected plunge, but squinting up as their heads appeared over the rim. Fortunately for Teller, the sharpened stakes that had once studded the floor of the pit had rotted to mulch. The fall, however, had damaged some of the mimetic circuits of his camouflage suit, and he was alternately blending in with the mulch and visible to the naked eye.
"I made it as easy as I could for you to stalk me, Captain," Tarkin said, using the rank Teller had earned during the Clone Wars. "I even left my stormtroopers behind in Iriadu City."
"Very big-hearted of you, Governor. Or do I have to start calling you Grand Moff now?"
Teller tried to get to his feet, but promptly winced in pain and sat back down to inspect a clearly broken ankle.
"I knew you were leading me on," he said, through gritted teeth, "but it didn't matter. Not as long as I had a shot at getting to you."
"You had plenty of shots at getting to me, as you say. So why not when we were in the air? And why a simple hand blaster rather than a sniper rifle?"
"I wanted us to be looking each other in the eye when I killed you."
Tarkin grinned faintly.
"Sadly predictable, Captain. And so unnecessary."
Teller snorted.
"Well, this old fossil would probably have killed me before I got off a shot anyway."
"You're right about that,"
Jova said good-naturedly. He and Tarkin stepped back from the rim. Jova stomped down an area of razor grass with his wide, calloused feet, and they sat facing each other.
"Were you surprised to hear from me, Uncle?"
Tarkin asked. Jova shook his hairless, nut-brown head.
"I knew you'd return someday. I had to renovate some of your old traps. Lucky you recalled where you dug them."
He paused to grin.
"Though I don't suppose luck has much to do with anything."
Tarkin gazed around him.
"I remember my time here like yesterday."
Jova nodded sagely.
"I've tried to keep abreast of your career. Haven't read or heard much about you the better part of 3 or 4 years now."
"Imperial business," Tarkin said, "and let it go at that.
But whatever success I've achieved is to your credit for mentoring me. My memoir will make clear your contributions."
Jova gestured in dismissal.
"I don't need to be singled out. I prefer being more of a phantom."
"Phantom of the plateau.
Why not?"
Tarkin got to his feet and returned to the rim of the pit.
"How's the ankle, Captain?"
"Swelling, I would imagine."
Teller's glower said it all.
"Need I remind you that we fought on the same side in the Clone Wars?"
Tarkin said.
"We fought to prevent the galaxy from splintering, and we achieved our goal. But where I've put that war behind me, you appear to be still waging it. You'd have the galaxy fracture again?"
"You haven't put it behind you," Teller said. "That war was nothing more than a prelude to the war the Emperor always had in mind. Subjugating separatists was practice for subjugating the galaxy. You've known all along, and this time you're going to crush your opponents before they have a chance to organize."
"That's called pacification, Captain."
"It's rule by fear. You're not just demanding submission, you're generating evil."
"Then evil will have to do."
Teller stared up at him.
"What transforms a man into a monster, Tarkin?"
"Monster? That's a point of view, is it not? I will say this much, however.
This place, this plateau, is what made me.
Tella considered it, then asked, What is the Empire building at Geonosis?
Tarkin showed him a faint grin. Unfortunately, Captain, you are not cleared to know that. But I'm willing to make a deal with you. I'm certain you'll have a difficult time extricating yourself from this trap you stumbled into. What with the depth of the hole, and now a broken ankle. But should you succeed, you will find your blaster just here, on the rim. He made a point of setting the weapon down. The most dangerous of the Carrion's predators don't appear until nightfall. They'll sniff you out, and, well, suffice it to say, you don't want to loiter down there. Of course, even if you manage to get out, it's a long way to the edge of the escarpment. He paused in thought, then added, I'll have Jova park your speeder at the base of the plateau. Should you make it off Iriadu alive, look me up, and I'll reconsider what I said about Geonosis.
Tarkin, Tella said, you will die horribly because you deserve nothing less. The more you try to coerce the disadvantaged to play by your rules, the more they will rebel. I'm not the only one.
You're hardly the first to prophesize my demise, Captain. And I could certainly make an equally dire prediction about your death. Because here you are, trapped in a deep hole and crippled. And that's precisely where I intend to keep the others of your ilk. Teller smiled with his eyes.
Then if I can escape, the rest will.
Tarkin returned the look. That's an interesting analogy. Let's see how it plays out in real life, and in the long run. Until then, farewell, Captain. Jova stood up as Tarkin approached, gesturing with his stubbled chin to the hole. Broken ankle or no, he seems capable enough to escape. Do you want me to keep an eye on him? Perhaps provide a hint or two of the lay of the land to better his chances? Tarkin stroked his jaw. That might be interesting. You be the judge. And if he makes it down off the plateau in one piece and to his speeder? Tarkin mulled it over. Learning that he's actually at large will keep me on my toes. Jova smiled and nodded. A good strategy. We are never too old to learn new tricks.
The epicenter of a bustling throng of construction droids, supply ships, and cargo carriers, safeguarded by 4-star destroyers and twice as many frigates, the Deep Space Mobile Battle Station hovered in fixed orbit above secluded and forbidding Geonosis. When viewed from mid-system, or from even as close as the asteroid belt that further isolated the planet from celestial interchange, one could be fooled into believing that the irradiated world had added another small moon to its collection. Still youthful, the spherical station had yet to grow into the features by which it would be recognized a decade on. The northern hemisphere focus lens frame for the superlaser was scarcely more than a metallic crater. The Quadanium hull, a mere patchwork of rectangular plates, so that one could see almost to the heart of the colossal thing. The sphere's surface city sprawls and equatorial trench might as well have been dreams. By the time Tarkin arrived, at the conclusion of his travels through the Outer Rim systems, some of the hyperdrive components had been installed, but the station was far from being jump-ready. Nevertheless, work on some of its array of sublight engines had recently been completed, and those were ready to be tested, if only to determine how well the globe handled. The project's chief scientists and engineers had taken Tarkin on a tour of finished portions of the station that had lasted a week, and yet he still hadn't seen half of it. From the interior of a repulsor lift construction craft, his guides had pointed out where the shield and tractor beam generators would be installed. They had laid out their plans for housing a staff and crew of 300,000. They had described gun emplacements, mooring platforms, and defensive towers that would stipple the gray skin.
Tarkan was in his glory. If he felt at home on the bridge of a star destroyer, here he felt centered. The station was a vast technoscape, ripe for exploration, an unknown world awaiting his stamp of approval and his mastery. While most of the construction work was done in micro-G, omnidirectional boosters supplied standard gravity to a large cabin space near the surface that would one day become the overbridge, with designated posts for Tarkan and various military officers. A conference room featuring a circular table, a holonet booth dedicated to communicating with the Emperor, and banks of large view screens. There, in the company of the station's designers and construction specialists, Tarkan gave the order for the sublight engines to engage. A faint shudder seemed to run through the orb, though Tarkan thought that the vibration could easily be the effect of exhilaration, coursing through him in a way he hadn't experienced since his teenage years. Then, with almost agonizing sluggishness, the battle station began to leave its fixed orbit. Ultimately, it surpassed the speed of the planet's rotation, emerging from the shadow of Geonosis and moving into deep space.
This is Ewan Morton. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Star Wars, Tarkan, by James Luceno. This program was directed by Scott Sherritt, executive producer Aaron Blank. Star Wars, Tarkan, is a production of Lucasfilm Limited and registered or trademarked where indicated. Copyright 2014, all rights reserved, used under authorization. Music composed by John Williams. Music publishing by Warner Tamerlane Publishing Corporation and Bantha Music. Music Master Production Copyright 2007, Lucasfilm Limited. This has been a Penguin Random House audio presentation. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.